Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest tonight is Dr. John Mosher. We're talking about the super civilization and how the survival in the era of human versus human. We're going to talk a little bit in a little bit about his Humans for a Healthier World concept, which really gets to more of the solutions around this. But we really want to dive a little bit more into climate control. And all this is to raise awareness around what we could be considered as controlled society, but we wouldn't be if we are aware of it. And speaking of awareness, I have a book coming out, a new book coming out. I'm really excited. On May 19th is the launch date of my new book, and I am going to be on George's show that night, which is really exciting. My book is called Becoming Aware, and it's on Amazon now. And it's about that a very tragic near-death experience that I had, and how I rebuilt my brain from that experience to come to this moment now. So it's a great story. I'd love you to check it out, and there's also a lot of great things to learn. So you can check that out on Amazon at Becoming Aware is the name of the book. I will be right back with my guest, John Mosher, after the break. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr, and my guest is Dr. John Mosher. We were talking before the break about antibiotic use and the cost of the antibiotic use going up. Could you explain a little bit more about that and what it has to do with your conversation around super civilizations?
Yeah, it's the pattern that I see not just in medicine, but in looking at how we're dealing with human-induced problems as we get along into the book, and we talk about the other more human-induced, purely human-induced problems. Is what happens is in the disease process, we conquer these diseases, but it costs us more and more and more as we go along. So what's happening is, we're getting killed with our kindness. Now, we always want to make sure that we do the best we can with every single human being, particularly in this country where we want to make sure we take care of all of our people. And anyone who comes into my emergency department, I treat with the exact same respect, exact same treatment. Whether you are an indigent or whether you're a multimillionaire, you get the exact same treatment. That's our goal. The end result is, though, is in producing that type of solution, you're ratcheting up costs on an astronomical level. And why that pattern now gets put into play is now we're talking about dealing with, for example, climate change, where every year that goes by or every day that goes by that we don't reduce our CO2 emissions, the amount it's going to cost us in the end to maintain our standard of living, to tread water, is growing astronomically. And that's the problem. And that's why I call this the era of human versus human, is that we know how to solve a lot of these problems. For example, climate change, we know how to solve it. Okay? We don't. We choose not to. Why do we choose not to resolve climate change? The only thing that I see happening right now is, and God bless him, is Governor Brown in California, and he's starting a trend, hopefully, but he's really ambitious about and quite prescient in his capabilities of looking at the future and acknowledging that we've got a huge problem here, and we're going to have to deal with it now. And for every year that we wait, it's going to cost us more and more.
Now,
So that's what I see happening with climate change.
you said that we know how to solve climate change. Can you dive into that a little deeper? Because you can't just say that without backing it up.
Yeah, we simply stop using fossil fuels. It sounds easy, doesn't it? It's not. It's very difficult. Okay,
No,
but
yeah.
we know what the cause is. See, we know what the problem is that's producing the climate change. If you look at the past in our history over the last 4 million years, we had no understanding of our environment. We had no understanding of what we were doing or what. And I'm not talking about resource utilization, because resources were specific to those specific areas of your civilization or where you were living, so you had very little understanding of the science. Today, we understand the science of climate change, And unfortunately, we choose not to address those problems. And the reason why we don't address those problems is because those individuals who control the agenda, i.e. Congress, you know, what else are you going to say? Congress and the president and politics have basically chosen not to address this problem. And, you know, the classic example is in the presidential debates in 2012. It's basically not one question, not one reference was made in any of the presidential debates to climate change, which is the biggest, massive problem facing humanity, and
it was
not
like,
one word on it.
No, it was like death in a campaign speech. Yes, that's true. Yeah, it wasn't.
And it was only when President Obama was safely in his second term, and I give him credit because I support what he's trying to do with the EPA, and he's trying to use the EPA as his tool to combat climate change. He does acknowledge it, but I would ask the president simply, why didn't you mention this in the presidential debate? I think the United States, people of the United States would like to know why he never mentioned it in a presidential debate. You know, that's just my own personal opinion. And the end result is that because vested interests that the wealthiest of the wealthy in the wealthiest countries, that is in the United States, and the top 1%, and if you want to mention the Koch brothers, they're right in there. They have basically funded those individuals who will not address climate change. And unfortunately now, in our neck of the woods, you're in California too, in my neck of the woods in Silicon Valley, hopefully people like Tom Steyer are going to be putting more money to candidates who will address this problem. But I fear that we're too late. That's what I fear.
Well, and when you said with that every day that goes by that we are going to pay for it in the end, when is that in the end?
You know what?
I mean,
I'm not a geophysicist, right?
100 years? I mean, just estimate 100 years, 200 years, 1,000 years?
No, what I would say is that I've used the date, and this is what I call the golden hour of humanity, 2040. Is the date that we've got to, and most, I don't want to say most, but the literature from what I've read, that a lot of the geophysicists are saying that we have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 85% by the year 2040, maybe 2050. And that's a fairly conservative estimate based upon the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and their reports. And most noticeably about the IPCC is that they're being fairly conservative to protect themselves against those individuals who are looking for any way, shape, or form to criticize them. So I would argue, and I've looked at the report, I would argue that their report is on the conservative side, conservative being that they're not looking at radical change as much as it potentially could. Occur over the next 10 to 20, 30 years.
In saying the golden hour of humanity is this is when it would be basically that synergistic catastrophe that you were talking about.
I think my goal in writing this book is to simply get the 7 billion people of the world on the same page and say, hey, look, we've got to work cooperatively together to solve our major problems. And right now, climate change is a symptom. And let me repeat that. It's not the problem. It's a symptom of a super civilization in which we are not working cooperatively together, and we are without firm leadership. We have a United Nations that basically is a Ban Ki-moon is a figurehead. He begs people, and he has no ability, no inherent ability, to orchestrate a deal. He tries at all the summits, and he does the best he can. And he is basically doing as much as he can given the framework he has and the institutions that he has. But bottom line, we don't have the institutions in place currently to deal with climate change.
However,
that's what my goal is.
It is the one movement that unifies the entire world. So if we really were to have the ability, it's a matter of unifying the people and all of the 2 million movements out there that address climate change to become one. But
Miss Gar, I just want to say you're right on, and that's why I wrote the book. I didn't write the book to say we're going to die off.
Right.
I wrote the book because we have so much potential to work cooperatively, and also, and I use the term global realization. I'm a global humanist. I took the Hippocratic Oath. It kills me. I don't care if you live across the street. I don't care if you live in Africa. I don't care if you live in Asia. I don't want to see people suffering. I don't want to see people going through starvation, having disease processes. And what I found in my book is that it is going to come back to bite us in the United States. And that's why, you know, I'm getting to the purely human-induced problem of terrorism. That's why one reason why we have terrorism, not the sole reason, but one of the reasons, because we have not addressed adequately the capital flows that are not occurring into the third world, and we're going to pay a price for it. So we have got to all work together and work cooperatively, and that's my goal, is to create the a movement to sign the Mission Statement for Humanity, which is to get people all on the same page to solve our most challenging problems, which, again, the two most challenging that I see are climate change and terrorism, and then the runaway medical industrial complex. And mm-hmm. if you put them all together, it has the same solution that I'm proposing, which is more cooperation and a global institution that we need to provide leadership in these areas.
All right, so why do you think this hasn't been done effectively up to this point? One global institution.
Yeah, let me just say that the internet, when the United Nations came about in the 1940s after World War II, there were all these, I would say, optimistic views of the role of the United Nations and where it was going to go. But at the time, let me put it bluntly, we didn't have the interconnectedness that we do today. We still were separated by continents, and if you look at how long it took us to get from one continent to another and communicate between countries, there was really no reason to be able to govern globally and have stronger global governance. It just wasn't practical at that time, even though supporters like Albert Einstein, Winston Churchill, they all went through a stronger global governance. Today is what I'm arguing is that it's not only, I mean, Alexander Wendt, who I emailed because I read his quote, he basically said the development of a global government is inevitable. It's just, it's going to happen. Or we're going to see a die-off. And simply, we're now at a point where our interconnectedness is so great, our declining resource base is so problematic, and we've got increasing interconnectedness that, and I'm open to anyone who wants to email me or contact me,
because
any other solutions to get us through the golden hour of humanity, the year 2040, when we have to solve the climate change problem.
I mean, it sounds idealistic, though, Dr. Mosher. It sounds like to have a global government that is all, you know, for the survival of the planet, if it was that easy, it would have been done by now, is what I'm saying.
Well, what I'm arguing is that the growth of the internet occurred in the 1990s, so we're about 20 years into it. Keep in mind that change, social change, can take a while.
Right.
If you look, for example, at what we can do when we put our minds to it, look at President Kennedy in 1961, and by 1969, we did have a man on the moon. So, you're right. My ideals are out there, and I also acknowledge the fact that it's a dream. But guess what? Let's start talking about it. Let's start talking about more cooperation, and also keep in mind one of the criticisms that people have had of, well, Big Brother's involved, et cetera. Well, can you imagine for a second? I'd rather implement a democratic government with full liberties, okay? So not just a democratic government, but a democratic government with a Bill of Rights, such as enlisted by in the United States Constitution. I'd like to be able to plan this well in advance, like our forefathers did, then to come upon a situation where someone crazy like an Assad or Kim Jong-un or some terrorist blackmails the White House or blackmails all of us, that could end up more tragic than a Hitlerian existence.
Well, so I mean, there's so many conversations going here, but what would be your plan on doing this, and how would you make it so that it doesn't have so many holes in it that it would then get attacked by terrorists?
Yeah, my first thought is this, is I laid a blueprint out there with the realization that it's only designed to be a suggestion. I don't for the least bit, I am not a diplomat, I am a physician. That means that I am not claiming to be an all-knowing person with all the solutions. So let me start that out by saying that. But I certainly am a human being, and I'm a member, like you are, like everyone else, of the super civilization. 7 billion people, we all need to work together. And I dedicated 10 years of my life to writing this book and coming up with these ideas. And I challenge anyone out there to simply look at what I've written and then simply add to it. And much like a Wikipedia, here's my first Wikipedia. So let's go ahead and bring others to the table. Let's
start the conversation.
Let's not be like we were in 2001, where we had the FBI saying, well, you can't talk about this and you can't talk about this.
Right. Right.
So why are we having this conference then if we can't talk about it?
You've definitely brought up the conversation, which is good, and we will be opening the phones for comments about this as well. But I just wanted to get to just a couple more levels here. Is what would be your ideal civilization? What would it be like? What would that global institution look like?
Yeah, first of all, I want to, again, point out that it's up to everyone's imagination. So I want to say that I'm 1/7 billionth of the world's population. So I came up with this. It would be great if everyone else came up with the idea. Then we all worked together and we all created a stronger leadership. And that's really what it's about, is stronger leadership on a global level, so that we don't have a problem communicating and dealing on levels. Keep in mind also climate change was thrust upon you, and you said, well, how come this hasn't been done before? Climate change is the very first problem, and think about this, the very first problem that we've ever had as a species, where all 7 billion people, or all members of the species, must cooperate.
Yes.
In a similar fashion. No other time has that occurred. So that's why the 21st century is what I call the century of the super civilization. So you asked my question, it's simply this, I just put it out there for thoughts, is that I think we would benefit first by having discussions at least about not the symptoms such as climate change, but talks about, okay, how do we create better leadership in the world? Do we strengthen the United Nations? Do we strengthen the role of the U.S. government? Do we strengthen the Chinese government? Or, as I believe, the issue of sovereignty, and that's the problem with the United Nations, by the way. The problem with the United Nations that they formulated in 1945 or so was that it's inherent in that institution that you respect the sovereignty of each and every country. That means that each and every country basically has the right to do whatever it wants to do with its own people. Now, it's evolved since then, so that naturally you can't go and have mass genocide, and the United Nations would go in. But if you stop to think about that major problem, the United Nations may not be capable of ever dealing with global governance. So I think we probably need a whole new institution. And I used...
We're going to take another quick break, Dr. Mosher, to talk about what that institution would look like, how people will get involved, what would be your first steps in something like that. So we will take a quick break. We'll come back after the break. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is Dr. John Mosher. His book is called The Super Civilization, Survival in the Era of Human versus Human. And the book is really about how will we survive? If he says that geophysicists predict that by the year 2040, this could be the golden era of humanity, then how do we change that trajectory? Dr. Mosher suggests that it's by going into a global institution, a type of a global leadership, and having a stronger leadership on a global level. I want to find out what you think about that as well. So we're going to take your calls in a little bit, and we will be back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. My guest is John Mosher, Dr. John Mosher. We're talking about the super civilization, the name of his book. So, John, before the break, we were talking about building a stronger leadership on a global level. Let me ask you about the kind of a simplicity movement, because it seems to be linked to what you're talking about here. Are you talking about more of a minimalistic type of global leadership, something that is not as consumer oriented, that is definitely a reserving of our resources in that level? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm grasping at anything we can get. Right now, I in my book, I've offered up the mission statement for humanity, which is a 10-point plan, including global government and an independent branch of healthcare for the entire world, a little different than the World Health Organization, which is basically a monitoring agency. I'd rather like to see an entirely freestanding institution throughout the world that would administer healthcare based upon a pre-designated amount of funding based upon per capita GDP per the world, or the GDP per the world as a percentage, however the economists and physicians wanted to, and public health officials wanted to do it. So there's those were my suggestions for the direction we should go. But right now, I want to just try to encourage our leaders to start taking a stronger role with the guidance of all of humanity in a liberal democracy. And unfortunately, we don't have all 7 billion people in liberal democracies. And according to Transparency International, in fact, we have less than ideal amount. I forget the number, but it's probably, I'm guessing, 50% to 70% of all
Right.
individuals are a liberal democracy
I
at some
mean,
point. I'd like to see that amended 100%.
how would you get all 7 billion people to agree on the same thing?
Ah, there's a conundrum, isn't it?
Oh,
We can't get everyone to agree on everything. We got 306 or 310 million people to agree on the U.S. Constitution. So if we can get 310 million people to agree on that, I'm hopeful that we can get 7 billion people in this day and age of the internet to agree to some type of a constitution. 1948, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was created. And if you ask an American citizen if they've ever heard of that, I'm going to guess that very few would have. So it hasn't had the impact that we were hoping. And of course, it hasn't had the impact because it's not, people don't identify with the human species. They identify with their country, with their family. And I think we've got to work to try to change that. We have to work to try to get people to realize that if we don't get all seven people to agreeing to some of the most basic aspects, such as human rights, the capability
Well,
of providing
I mean, even.
a minimum standard of living, then we can go ahead and start moving in the directions that hopefully we can partake in.
I mean, I love what you're talking about. I think it is a bit idealistic because, look, if in the US, a person's model of a family is something, it's a loving family unit that hopefully contributes back to society. If you're in another country, the family unit could be to kill as many people as possible in order to contribute back to society. I mean, there's so many different versions of what this one theory is all about, and they're all in the own individual minds justified.
Well, before the 21st century, basically, well, let's take McDonald's, okay, just as an example. I hope I'm not offending any of your sponsors or anything, but let's just take McDonald's or Starbucks or whatever. The allegiance that people have now to those products versus their nation I'm going to guess that it's stronger for those companies and those corporations than it is for their nations. So the culture, the cultural context that you're bringing up, which is, you know, a valid argument of, well, how can you get all 7 billion people to agree upon this? The 21st century is a brand new century in which we all have common cultural views. And in order for us to live at the standard of living that we live at, we're dependent upon every aspect of the super civilization. And so we have signed, you know, sociologists talk about a social contract. I talk about a mandatory social contract. Unless you want to see your standard of living drop precipitously, you're going to participate in the super civilization.
What would be on that contract? Example. What's that look like?
The social contract?
Yeah, as an example.
For example, the Mission Statement for Humanity. If we could get everyone to sign the Mission Statement for Humanity, that would go a long ways towards getting everyone on the same page as far as human rights, the right to water, the right to food, the right to minimum standard of living, the right to health care, those minimum standards. And we are improving. I mean, I don't want to say that it's a total disaster. Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations, Jeffrey Sachs has done an incredible job with that, and we're moving in the right direction. But at some point, we have to say, in our golden hour, we're running out of time and energy to achieve those goals. If we're not careful, the terrorism problem that, you know, I've alluded to in my book is going to become so great that it's going to lead to synergistic catastrophe. So I think the one thing that I'm trying to do is get people to identify as a global humanist and say, okay, we need to all look out for each other, all 7 billion people, whatever country you live in, we need to look out for everyone. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist right now. And keep in mind, too, I love my country. In fact, I would say, to be honest with you, the idea for a stronger global governance is centered on the Constitution. I believe that our Constitution is the greatest document that was ever created. So I want to export that. I don't want to export arms and tanks and guns, and we have enough of those. Let's start exporting the Constitution.
All right, well, let's get to some questions from the listeners, and let's go to our wild card line in Maui. Is it Franklin?
Yes.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Dr. Mosher, you're right on. Have you ever read the book Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy?
No, I've heard of it, but I haven't had a chance to look at it.
What he did in the 1800s was talk about a utopian society, which would be great if everybody contributed to it. But you're right on about it has to be a world government. There's no way that we can survive without that. And I'd really like to read your book. Please tell me the name of it again.
Yes, thank you very much. It's The Super Civilization, Survival in the Era of Human versus Human. It can be purchased on Amazon or on our website, healthierworld.us. We also have other websites, missionstatementforhumanity.us, to sign the mission statement.
And there's different versions of the book, right? There's the Reader's Digest version, and then there's the one with all of the notes, right?
Thank you. Yeah, that's basically what it is. It's the first thing I started out when I wrote this is I wanted to make sure that the theory was complete. And so that was the theoretical version, and that has over 1,300 references and is available to the academic or to anyone who wants to check my references and see how I came to my conclusions. Then the abridged version is without all the notes, and it basically is a kind of a synopsis about one-third the size that goes into my theories. And then the Reader's Digest version is about 150 pages or so that basically summarizes all my conclusions that I've come to. So, yeah, that's very kind of you, and I'll try to get a look at that at the book. In a utopian society, by the way, there's nothing wrong with wanting to have a utopian society. I think the only thing I want to point out is that I realize that utopian societies will always exist, like a rainbow, it'll always be in the distance, but we've got to start at least moving in that direction, I think, if we're going to solve these major problems.
Okay, great. All right, well, thank you so much for your call, Franklin. I appreciate it. All right, let's go to James in Kentucky. James, do you have a question or comment for Dr. Mosher?
Yes. I wanted to get his view on individual sovereignty, the individual, not nation. I realize nations have their own sovereignty or they obey their own laws and stuff, but what do you think about individual sovereignty and or freedom?
Yeah, thank you very much. Perhaps there's a little misunderstanding among some people who would say that I'm not for individual rights, that I'm for group rights or socialist, et cetera. I'm a humanist. And what I'm looking for when I started this, as I said, was a blank slate. I was looking to say, okay, how can we solve the major problems that that we have? And what happened in 9/11, the agony that many people went through and the death and the destruction. And I was trying very hard to ask myself, what can we do to avoid these issues? Well, it gets back then individual rights. And, you know, if you want to look back at the philosophers, you know, that Immanuel Kant and Montesquieu, and, you know, go back to the philosophy of individual rights versus the rights of society. Keep in mind that in those eras, before the era of massive interconnectedness, and Ms. Garr, I also left out one minor factor in the super civilization, which was the advancement of technological capability to annihilate ourselves, particularly with atomic weapons or nuclear weapons. If you put those into perspective, individual rights and liberties are important to a certain extent. You can no longer simply go around and take and launch a bomb into someone's backyard. You just can't. I mean, that's just the reality of it. You can't you can't possess a howitzer in your backyard. What I'm in favor of simply is this: is achieving those goals that I sent out in the mission statement for humanity. If that requires us to work cooperatively and to limit individual rights and individual sovereignty, we need to do it in a very delicate way and avoiding a big brother issue.
Well, can I say something else, please?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I hate to say this, but what you're talking about is what at the beginning of what your response to my question was, you just said it at the end, that you want to get rid of individual rights, and that sounds like something that is never going to work. That hasn't worked in any time at the present or in looking back in time. And there have been several people who have tried that, who want to go utopian and all that stuff. It never works. People get slaughtered when that thought comes about. So I'm sorry, sir, but your philosophy is wrong. Individual rights is the way to go. If the individual is not sovereign, then the individual has no power. Utopia doesn't work without individual power.
John, do you have a comment about that?
Well, first of all, my goal is to free as many people as we can from the clutches for example, communist China. I think that communist China is, I'm hoping, is a chameleon that'll free billions of people from the clutches without the Bill of Rights. I'm the biggest supporter of the Bill of Rights. I want to give people freedoms, but we also have to acknowledge that we just can't necessarily give everyone carte blanche to any idea, any thought, any form of behavior without at least acknowledging some type of framework for those the ability of those people to do those types of behaviors.
Do you get that comment often, Dr. Mosher? You suggested that was something that was familiar to you.
Oh, absolutely. When you're proposing the super civilization mm-hmm. and you're looking at large governance, mm-hmm. The first question that's going to come out is that we don't want Big Brother.
Now,
and what? And my argument is that we're trying to avoid Big Brother by planning a government similar to that of the United States that has a full Bill of Rights, that has full protections for individuals. So I'm a huge supporter of individual liberties as outlined in the U.S. Constitution.
Meaning individuals making up the whole.
I'm sorry, I missed that part.
Individuals making up the whole civilization, but not taking away the rights of the individuals.
The reality is that, again, you can't harbor a howitzer, you can't harbor 5 kilograms of plutonium. You've got to create some laws that will limit the behaviors of individuals. But what I want to do is I want to encourage the entirety of humanity to outline those rights for all and not let someone like Assad or who rains down with chemical weapons on his own people make that the deciding factor. I want to free people. I advocate freeing people throughout the world and creating a liberal democracy throughout the world.
Where do you think we are right now and currently? Do you feel that we're in the middle of what you're talking about?
Well, unfortunately, I'm so nervous about where the world's heading because I feel that when we're in the middle, it's a no man's land.
Right, bit of a gap.
Right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly, because we've got to move. We've got to stick and move, you know, as we say in basketball, stick and move. We've got to be able to move forward because we're now so interconnected that who's leading the world? Is it President Obama or is it the Premier of China or is it, who is actually leading? No one's leading. And I'd argue in the beginnings of this country when we had an Articles of Confederation and et cetera, that it didn't work as well, I don't think, as the U.S. Constitution with this stronger leadership. So that's, I think I'm simply arguing that we're not realizing that we're so interconnected that we already have the makings of a homogeneous culture. But let me also point out, you're absolutely right, and I will agree with the caller on this, is that I think it would be quite dangerous if the government had unrestrained power, and that's why the U.S. is such a great country, is because we do limit the power of our leaders. The leaders report to us. Our president reports to us. He works for me, works for you, works for everyone.
Ultimately.
My member of Congress, Mike Thompson, he works for me. Your member of Congress works for you, and it should be like that. And unfortunately, in a lot of the world, a high percentage of the world, it isn't like that.
It doesn't feel like it's like that. However, I couldn't, get my congressperson to do something for me in Congress. I mean, it doesn't feel that way. It feels like you have to have a greater group behind you, and you have to, lobby people, and you have to get against privatization and big money and big business. And it doesn't feel like that.
You know what? You brought up a great point because this is the mission statement for humanity. And what I argue is that I think the Citizens United case, again, maybe someday it will be overturned, but the ability now in our Congress, and this is why, again, the United States is the greatest country, but we do have our flaws. And I think a major flaw that we have currently is the unlimited spending it's kind of a little game that they play where the party gets the money, but the candidate doesn't. But in essence, the candidate ends up with the money, and you have the unrestrained power of corporate dominance. And what I advocate is that corporations, that we limit all campaign spending in this purported global governance, we limit the spending on each individual candidate to a certain
That's been talked about for a while. Yep, absolutely. All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we will come back with your phone calls and Dr. Mosher after the break. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.